Thank you for downloading this podcast of Ion Entertainment from Abilene Public Radio. To find more episodes and to see our terms of use, visit us online at kacu.org. From Abilene Public Radio, this is Ion Entertainment. I'm Blaine Singletary. Summer has officially started, and with that, many people are headed into summer vacations. Many of those people take time to enjoy the landmarks around our country. Those heading up north to New York City will most likely spend some time at the Statue of Liberty. One man has been spending a lot of time with this iconic landmark lately. Dr. Edward Berenson is a professor of history at New York University and the author of a new book, The Statue of Liberty, A Transatlantic Story. And he joins us now on the line. Ed, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Happy to be with you.
Now, I should mention that you're also the director of the Institute of French Studies, and Modern Europe is really your field of study and a subject of many of your previous books. And one may question why you would turn your sights to a uniquely American icon, but it's true that this statue is actually very heavily rooted in European architecture and affairs.
Yeah, so I thought it would be a good way to broaden my sights a little bit, and it's true that I spent most of my career working on European history and French history especially, but I'm an American, I'm a New Yorker, and so the Statue of Liberty seemed to me a perfect way to put together the different sides of who I am, both professionally and personally, and it turned out to be really a great project to do from that point of view.
An interesting thing I learned from this book is that American support for this monument was actually hard to get at the time it was first proposed.
Yeah. Well, when you sort of go back to the late 1800s, and so we're in the 1870s, and this French sculptor named Frederick Bartholdi comes over to the United States. He doesn't speak a word of English. He doesn't know anybody. And he wants to convince Americans that they should allow him to build the largest statue in the world, to put it in the most prominent place in New York Harbor, and that they should allow him to build it the way he wants, and furthermore, that the Americans should pay for the pedestal it's going to stand on. So it was kind of a hard sell at first, and it was also partly because in that time period, Americans didn't do that kind of thing. You know, we were just beginning to become an industrialized country, and we saw ourselves as being productive and not really investing very much in public art. The Europeans, of course, had been doing that for a long time, but that was not something that we were yet accustomed to. And so here was a European, a Frenchman who came over and said, I want to basically go in with you, Americans, and create this monumental piece of public art, and I want to put it in New York Harbor.
And it was actually in its early days and getting off the ground, so to speak. It was championed a lot by some of the great minds of the day. They kind of played a bit of a role in its conceptualization and also even after it was built, Rudyard Kipling, Joseph Pulitzer.
Right. So on the French side, there were some very prominent people who were behind the thing. So there was the brother of de Tocqueville. Tocqueville himself had died a few years earlier, and there was a grandson of Lafayette, and there was a man named Edouard de Laboulaye, who was the leading expert in France on the United States, and then there was this up-and-coming young sculptor, Frederick Bartholdi. On this side of the ocean, there was an elite group of New Yorkers who got interested. They were members of the Union League Club, which was a really kind of prestigious thing to be in, and it still exists, and top businessmen and professionals belong to it. And then, during the fundraising effort to put up the pedestal, Joseph Pulitzer got involved. Pulitzer, of course, was the publisher and editor of the New York World, and he got involved because this Blue Blood American Committee was having a really hard time coming up with the money to pay for the pedestal. And so Pulitzer sort of shrewdly saw this as a way of making a contribution while at the same time selling newspapers. And so what he did is he talked to his readership, and it was a very sort of popular kind of newspaper, not at all highbrow. And he said, these elite moneyed people aren't, they're not coming up with a fund, so we should do that. We should show them. We should show them that we're the ones, we ordinary people, are the ones who believe in liberty. And so he said that anybody who contributes any amount, no matter how small, will have his or her name printed in my newspaper. And if you write a letter with your contribution explaining why you're interested in this, I might print an excerpt of your letter. And in fact, he did print a fair number of excerpts. And this worked. People who ordinarily would never see their names in print got their names in the newspaper, and they were praised by Pulitzer for contributing to this project. And 121,000 different, just regular people,
wow,
sent in money, and it averaged less than a dollar apiece, and Pulitzer raised the $100,000 that they needed to put the fundraising campaign over the top.
Wow.
It's quite a story.
Certainly, yeah. And is this kind of the point where Americans as a whole began to accept this idea,
yeah,
of this colossus?
Yeah, absolutely. So by this point, Pulitzer had done a brilliant job of publicizing it. He printed drawings, lithographs of the statue. And so people knew what the Statue of Liberty looked like even before it went up. And I think Pulitzer and other newspaper publishers, and especially the publishers of the Illustrated Press, I think they played a big role in making the Statue of Liberty possible, because they printed so many pictures of it, because it was a dramatic thing. It was, after all, the largest statue in the world. And so I think in the minds of a lot of newspaper readers, the Statue of Liberty existed here even before it went up. And I think that played a really big role in making it possible for it to happen.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just structurally large. It also had a large amount of influence. And what I find remarkable, and you point this out, is that for every generation or even a demographic of people, it meant something different to them.
Yeah, that's really one of the things I think is most fascinating about the history of the Statue of Liberty, partly because it's abstract. It's not a statue of anybody, or it means it's a Statue of Liberty, but that's also an abstract concept. And so it leaves itself open for different kinds of interpretations. One interesting thing is that the French people who conceived it, they wanted to say by building the Statue of Liberty that they loved the American form of liberty and they wished their own country were more like ours in their political system, but they also wanted to say how happy they were that slavery had been abolished in this country. And so one of the original forms of symbolism, the Statue of Liberty, was as a monument to the abolition of slavery, and that's why there are broken chains under the Statue of Liberty's feet. And then with the famous poem by Emma Lazarus, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses," began the idea that the Statue of Liberty would be the symbol of the open door to people from all over the world who wanted to come to this country to find new opportunities. But that symbol was it had a sort of rough early existence, because when the Statue of Liberty went up in 1886, the United States was in the middle of a very long economic recession, even a depression, and so unemployment was high, and whenever unemployment is high, immigration is controversial. Well, there were just floods of people pouring in from Southern Europe, Eastern Europe, and Russia in particular, and there were at best mixed feelings about all the people coming in. And so there were a number of people who were opposed to the statue, opposed to immigration, and they used the Statue of Liberty in the 1890s as the symbol of opposition to the Statue of Liberty. So you see, I publish some of these in my book, political cartoons of the Statue of Liberty holding her nose and hiking up her skirt so that she doesn't have to be contaminated by all of the riffraff who are coming in from abroad.
It was both interpreted as a sign for immigration and against it.
Yep, Yep. And it really didn't become a sort of universally recognized positive sign of immigration until the 1930s, when basically the huge flood of immigrants from Europe was over.
I see.
And then I just say, there's one more thing. Since 9/11, the Statue of Liberty has really come to stand for the resilience of the United States in New York City in the face of terrorism.
Yes. I think you even mentioned an interesting change that took place after 9/11 is now it's very hard to actually go up in the crown of the statue.
Yeah. They've understandably beefed up the security, because one of the things that we've sadly learned from those terrible attacks is that our opponents, our enemies, they want to kill people, but they also want to destroy the symbols of this country. And so the World Trade Centers were a symbol of our economic power, but the Statue of Liberty is really the symbol of America itself, and so it really could be vulnerable. And there have, in fact, been dissident groups and even terrorists who've tried to do damage over time to the Statue of Liberty. There were people in the 1960s, Quebec separatists, who had a plan to blow up the Statue of Liberty. And so I think 9/11 drove home to the National Park Service and federal officials in general that Statue of Liberty could be vulnerable. And so they really beefed up the security. And one way they did that is to limit to about 200 a day the number of people who are allowed to climb all the way to the top. Well, you can imagine, with about 4 million visitors to the Statue of Liberty a year, most people don't get to go up.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would you say is the main draw of this book?
Well, I think that there are an awful lot of things in the book about the Statue of Liberty that people really don't know. And so I think the Statue of Liberty is both totally familiar and also unknown. And I think that, I hope that my book will allow my readers to discover things about this very familiar and beloved monument that are fascinating, but that they don't know. I mean, for example, the Statue of Liberty stands because it has a skeleton that was originally made of wrought iron designed by Gustav Eiffel.
And the Eiffel Tower fame.
The Eiffel Tower guy. And so what you have basically inside the Statue of Liberty is a little Eiffel Tower. The same kinds of materials, the same construction techniques, the same engineering techniques that would later be on display in the Eiffel Tower are right there inside the Statue of Liberty. And another thing is about the way the Statue of Liberty is built. If you look at it, of course, it seems like this solid structure. In fact, the skin of the Statue of Liberty, what you see when you look at it, is a really, really, really thin layer of copper, about the width of a penny, that's held up by Gustav Eiffel's inner skeleton. And that's why the Statue of Liberty could be completely constructed in Paris and then taken down and put in 200 and some odd shipping containers and sent over here. That's another thing that a lot of the Americans I talk to when I give a talk about the book, they don't know that the Statue of Liberty was fully erected in Paris and stood there for 2 years before it was disassembled and shipped over to the United States.
Wow.
So I think a lot of things like that are really interesting to people, and I think people also just think that the Statue of Liberty has always been about immigration. It's always been the sign of the open door toward immigration, and I think readers are interested to find that there's a lot of different symbols that the Statue of Liberty has embodied, and also that people have used the Statue of Liberty for all different kinds of purposes. So for political purposes, right, left, and center, the different ideological groups in this country have used the Statue of Liberty. It's been used as a symbol of for the opponents of abortion, and for the people who believe in choice on that subject matter. So even something like that, the most controversial issues, people can use the Statue of Liberty as a symbol for one side or its opposite. And advertisers have used the Statue of Liberty to sell all kinds of products, and celebrities have dressed up as the Statue of Liberty. There was a magazine cover that that came out in a New York magazine, not New York magazine, but a magazine published here last fall with Lady Gaga dressed up as a Statue of Liberty.
Actually, down here in Abilene, there's every time around tax season, they have some people dressing up as the Statue of Liberty, you know, to advertise for various tax firms.
Oh, yeah, right. And there's the Liberty Mutual Insurance Company, I think it's called, that uses the Statue of Liberty's head as a symbol, as a logo of their company. And, of course, the Statue of Liberty has been in all kinds of films. So everybody remembers the final scene of Planet of the Apes when you see the kind of broken remains of the Statue of Liberty and Charlton Heston realizes that he's been on Earth all along.
And Ghostbusters 2, they use it.
Ghostbusters 2, right, the Statue of Liberty comes alive and does battle with the evil slime in the sewers of New York City. And then the really great Alfred Hitchcock movie, Saboteur, which came out in 1942 during the Second World War. And the bad guy is a German. And he ends up being defeated by the good guys on the torch of the Statue of Liberty.
Hmm.
And so, Hitchcock, it's a kind of World War II propaganda film. It's a particularly well-done one, but the Statue of Liberty serves the obvious purpose of demonstrating that we here in the United States have liberty, which is being threatened by the Germans.
Hmm. So it gives readers certainly a further glimpse into just the history and even the present of this structure.
Yep.
Well, having spent all this time in research and, of course, living nearby it, what would you say this landmark means to you?
Well, it's something I have lived with now for a number of years as I researched and wrote the book. I feel almost as if I have a personal relationship to it. You know, I've been there several times, and every time I've been there, it moves me that much more. And I'm awed by its beauty. I'm awed by how long it's been there. I'm awed by the profound meanings that it's taken on. And I'm also, as someone who has been interested in French history and French society, I'm also interested in the Statue of Liberty as it stands for this very long-standing relationship between France and the United States. It's been a difficult relationship, but and a lot of Americans don't know this, that France is one of the very few European countries that the United States has never been at war with.
Hmm.
Of course, we fought the revolution against the British, and we've been at war against Germany and Italy, and we had a long Cold War against the Soviet Union. And France, although there's been a lot of static between the two countries, De Gaulle and Roosevelt really disliked each other, and so that caused problems even during the Second World War when we were allies. But as most Americans know, the French intervened on our side during the Revolution and played a major role in ensuring the freedom and independence of the United States. And then, of course, we intervened in two world wars to help the French fend off the Germans. And so I think these things have been really important. And so being able to put these two sides of my life, my identity as an American, and my sort of kind of scholarly interests in French history. It's been really nice to be able to put those things together in this research project.
All right. Well, Ed Berenson, thank you for joining us today.
Great pleasure.
That's Ed Berenson, a professor of history at New York University and author of The Statue of Liberty, A Transatlantic Story, out now at a bookseller near you. For more information about the author, search Edward Berenson, that's Edward Berenson. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Ion Entertainment from Abilene Public Radio. To find more episodes and to see our terms of use, visit us online at kacu.org.